what the state's doing as far as predator control goes is common sense, you know?
The controversy over the state's shift in its predator control policy. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, the 17th of March. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, mushers battle brutal weather on the Iditarod Trail.
One thing to be windy, usually it's windy, it's warmer, but to have it bitter cold, that combination is really difficult.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. Iditarod coverage comes from Wells Fargo. Wells Fargo goes the distance for the Iditarod, an event that brings people together in the spirit of Alaska's heritage. Wells Fargo, the next stage.
State biologists are working from a helicopter to shoot wolves in the eastern interior. The action started over the weekend and is aimed at bolstering moose and caribou numbers in a sprawling predator control area south of the Yukon River. As KUAC's Dan Bross reports, the effort is drawing mixed responses.
State-sanctioned aerial wolf control has been underway in the upper Yukon Tanana country for the last 3 years. But until a few days ago, the job was left up to volunteer fixed-wing pilot gunner teams. Department of Fish and Game Regional Supervisor David James says state biologists have taken to the air in a helicopter to increase a harvest that's been well below objective. James says conditions are right for jump-starting the program.
For particularly the past 3 years, we've had unusually poor conditions, snow conditions and weather conditions, that have made it very difficult for our volunteer members of the public to whom we issue permits to conduct either aerial shooting or land and shoot shooting. And during those 3 years, we just have failed to meet our management goals out there. So it was felt that this year, with conditions being excellent right now, that the department should jump in as well.
State biologists have already shot more than 30 wolves with the goal of taking out 100. The state hopes its kill combined with public harvest will reduce the area's wolf population 75%, leaving fewer than 100 wolves in the 18,000 square mile control zone, a density on the low end of what's natural. The goal of the reduction is to increase local moose numbers and the size of the 40-mile caribou herd. Fish and Game spokeswoman Kathy Harms says the herd peaked at 500,000 animals at the beginning of the 20th century, but has been well below that for decades.
It seemed to have crossed a threshold into being a small herd, being held at those levels by predation.
Independent wildlife scientist Gordon Haber, who studied the 40-mile ecosystem and wolves in Alaska for decades, says the state's caribou population objective is unrealistic.
40-mile caribou numbers have about doubled since the late 1990s. So certainly to any claim that they're being held in a predator pit by wolves or anything else is just total nonsense.
Haber is also suspect of the state's 40-mile wolf population estimate, which he says includes animals from outside the control area. Eagle resident Sonia Sager says she's concerned about impacts to a genetic strain of very large wolves the local area is known for.
We're just worried that our kids are not going to be able to see the wolves that we were able to see, and we're not going to be able to trap them anymore either, because we'd feel bad doing so if we were catching the last ones, you know?
Another Eagle resident, Bo Fay, who serves on the local Fish and Game Advisory Committee, supports the wolf kill to increase the food available for locals.
What the state's doing as far as predator control goes is common sense, you know, because it should be managed as a food source.
The wolf kill is focused on the calving grounds of the 40-mile caribou herd between the Yukon River and the Alaska Highway and adjacent to the Yukon-Charlie National Preserve. Preserve Superintendent Greg Dudgeon says he only found out about the state kill plan last Thursday.
Frankly, I was surprised by that. This is the first that I had heard that the state agency was planning on doing so. And we began immediately talking about what we could do to help mitigate the possibility that wolves that have a primary home range within the preserve would be taken as a part of this wolf control effort.
Dudgeon says the Park Service has provided Fish and Game with radio frequencies of collared Yukon Charlie wolves so it can steer clear of any that roam onto state land. He says the state has agreed not to kill wolves from three Yukon Charlie Preserve packs and limit its take from two others. Some national groups have expressed outrage at news of the wolf kill. Friends of Animals President Priscilla Farrell faults a state administration she says is in retrograde when it comes to wildlife management.
And what that does is fuel all the worst ideas held by the biologists that work for Fish and Game. And the fault is really theirs because they tell Governor Palin that, you know, the science is on their sides and the ethics don't matter. And she's dim-witted enough to fall right into line with that kind of thinking.
The governor's office had no comment on Farrell's criticism. Farrell says predator control opponents are perplexed about what to do, given the minimal effect of tactics like tourism boycotts in the past. Fish and Game is allowed to kill wolves, but state workers are rarely employed to do so. Harm says prior to the current effort, in a similar one last spring on the Alaska Peninsula, the last time state employees killed wolves was in the early 1990s. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
Senator John McCain, who's long been against drilling the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, said he'd be open to directional drilling there if it proves it won't leave a footprint on the environment. The Republican senator from Arizona and former presidential candidate made his comments during a Senate Energy Committee hearing today. McCain asked Interior Secretary Ken Salazar to learn more about directional drilling and report back to the committee.
Obviously, if we don't believe the technology is there, that there's not going to be the kind of exploitation of those reserves that many advocate. As you know, I have not supported drilling in Anwar, but if technology is there, I certainly feel strongly that we ought to, and so that we don't disturb this pristine area, that we should certainly pursue it.
Alaska Senators Lisa Murkowski and Mark Begich are pushing directional or horizontal drilling as a way to access oil reserves believed to be below the refuge lands. They believe wellheads could be located outside the coastal plain's boundaries. Environmentalists have called the proposal unacceptable. Senator McCain pressed Interior Secretary Salazar today to weigh in. Salazar says he realizes the oil and gas industry has made technological advances in recent years.
So I understand the technology has significantly improved. Having said that, the position of the administration and my own position is that Anwar, as a national refuge, needs to be absolutely protected.
Salazar said, bottom line, at this point, his position on the Arctic Refuge has not changed. At today's hearing, Salazar also defended his decision to halt the Bush administration's five-year offshore drilling plan. Salazar said Bush was pushing it through prematurely and didn't take enough time to gather public comments. He will visit Anchorage on April 14th to host a day-long public hearing on offshore oil and gas development. A bill authorizing the financing for a new state office building along Juneau's waterfront has passed its first legislative hurdle. The plan would permit the Mental Health Trust to begin work next year on a 120,000-square-foot, four-story building to replace, initially, a building currently occupied by the Department of Labor. The department's lease of the building it occupies is up for renewal in 2012. Harry Noah, representing the trust, said other agencies could also move into the facility. The bill's sponsor, Juneau Republican Kathy Munoz, said she has talked directly to Governor Sarah Palin and anticipates her full support.
She wanted to make sure that the project penciled out and made financial sense for the state. And as you look through the numbers and as you compare lease costs and what we would have to put into the existing infrastructure, you can see that it is a better deal for the state over the long term. And also, the Mental Health Trust, the beneficiaries of the trust, will have great benefit over the long term by having a steady revenue stream to support mental health programs.
NOAA says the trust needs the bill to pass this session to get construction started in time. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, YK Delta residents hope a mine at Donlin Creek will create jobs.
They are really struggling at this moment. You know, there's only about 30-35% of the people working.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by BP Alaska. BP, where training Alaska's future workforce is a priority. And by the Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, operating and maintaining the Trans-Alaska Pipeline.
Lance Mackey is hours ahead of the rest of the field in this year's Iditarod Trail Sled Dog Race. He left the Elam checkpoint at 11 a.m. this morning. His closest competitors, Sebastian Schnula and John Baker, arrived at Elam 2 hours later. All of the mushers were battling low temperatures and fierce wind today. The leaders have usually reached the village of White Mountain by now, where there is a mandatory 8-hour layover. But Mackey isn't expected into the checkpoint until sometime later this evening. APRN trail reporter Tim Bodoni is there awaiting his arrival. Hi, Tim.
Hello, Lori.
Tim, what do you know about Mackey's progress along the trail?
It's been a rather conservative day for him and the rest of the field at that. There was a moment of opportunity perhaps today for John Baker or Sebastian Schnula, who are second and third place, to perhaps, if they had the dog power to do it, to forego any rest at Elam and do the run from Koyuk to White Mountain, about 85, 90 miles, in one long run. And neither of them chose to do that. Schnula and Baker chose to stop for at least a few hours, it looks like, at Elam. And that preserves Mackey's cushion as they come into the final stretch here.
How bad is the weather in the area?
Well, it's getting a little better from what I'm hearing, but still in the hills, which the trail from Koyuk to White Mountain does go into from time to time, the wind is still pretty fierce out of the north. I'm hearing that at Elam, a little calmer than yesterday, but and same for White Mountain, I can attest here. It's another clear, sunny day, not quite the wind strength, and a little bit warmer temperatures. And winds are expected to diminish by Thursday and to get a little bit warmer. And the question is, will the front runners wait for the break in the weather, or are they just going to tough it out and get the race over with?
Tim, what about the overall impact? How much have the conditions slowed this year's race?
The conditions have really served to bunch up the field behind Mackey. It's really Mackey and everybody else. And everybody else numbers somewhere around 20 teams at this point. At one point today, there were 13 teams stacked up at Shaktulik. And the lineup there was interesting in that you had Jeff King, who was running in the top five for most of this race, but having trouble moving up the coast, had a dog team that balked going into the wind out of Shaktulik, actually had to turn around and go back. He's been holed up there for a while, but all along with him at that same level is someone like a Ray Reddington Jr., who was back in the 30s or around 30th place back on the river, but now someone like a Ray Reddington Jr. is level with Jeff King. So there's going to be some potentially intense races for those the bottom of the top 10 spots and beyond here, so it could get very interesting for them. But again, I think the theme here as they finish the Iditarod is going into conservation mode. The biggest risk that these teams face is having a dog team that balks and that quits on them. Certainly they would rather take 8th place, 10th place, 13th place, rather than have to scratch at a late checkpoint.
Is there any risk to any of the mushers? Are people out on the trail in blizzard-like conditions, and or are most of them in a place now where they're safe?
Well, many did choose to venture out today after holing up for a while. And interestingly enough, someone like Dallas Stevie, the son of Mitch Stevie, has actually passed his father on the way to Koyuk. He was one that decided to venture out and brave the winds headed north. So it's all about whether these teams had the leaders that were willing to go into the wind. And also a very basic concern is that if they're to go out on the ice, for example, from Shaktulik to Koyuk, are they prepared to be marooned in the middle of nowhere for quite a while? Do they have enough dog food? Do they have enough people food?
All right. Well, thank you, Tim, for that update from White Mountain.
You're welcome.
Tim Bodoni is APRN's trail reporter in White Mountain. Mushers were worried about the wind and cold as they left the Unalakleet checkpoint yesterday. APRN's Annie Fite has the story.
As a reporter, you're supposed to be the one asking the questions, but as Sebastian Schnula fed his dogs in Unalakleet, he quickly turned things around on me.
Do you know the forecast of weather forecast?
It's supposed to be really cold tonight, like minus
40, I've heard. It was supposed to be windy, but it didn't seem to have died down in the last couple hours.
I mean, this is the least wind I've had here in a long time. This is not too bad.
In a few short hours, all that had changed. This was a scene behind the checkpoint as Seward musher Dallas Seavey prepared his team for the next run. All of Seavey's dogs had come down with a flu the day before. Despite the illness, he said they were still eating and drinking well, and that's why he was able to continue up the trail. But the dogs looked weary as he Velcroed blue wind-resistant coats on their backs.
You know, when they're feeling drained or worn down about one thing, makes other problems seem bigger, you know. If you're feeling sick and you've got to still go grocery shopping, makes shopping seem like a bigger deal, you know.
Inside the checkpoint, Two Rivers musher Allie Zirkel woke up from a nap and began the long process of putting on all her thick layers. Zirkel was preparing for the worst on the trail ahead.
Well, you know, there's some things you can protect dog from, and serious wind is hard to protect a dog from, so just worry about making sure I take care of them the best we can, you know.
Next to Zirkel, Dee Dee Jonro carefully laced up her boots. Jonro says it's hard to get the dogs moving into a stiff headwind. She's completed the race an incredible 24 times and says this Iditarod has been one of the tougher ones.
Cold and wind, really, you know. One thing to be windy, usually it's windy, it's warmer, but to have it bitter cold, that combination is really difficult because it's hard to do your chores, hard to take care of dogs.
Jonro also says she hasn't had a clear leader on her team so far this year.
But I have like several that are really making an enormous contribution, you know. So maybe they are standout leaders. Maybe that's what I'll tell you in Nome. But I need them to be, and you know, I don't know that they are yet. But I need them to be.
Along the hundreds of miles of trail, Allie Zirkel has had fun watching a pair of her three-year-olds work with each other. She describes Stormy as a tall, leggy dog who has a clear preference on the team.
She likes to hang on the right side of the trail. That's where her confidence level is. She tiptoes. She runs just right down the right side of the trail.
And then there's Stormy's brother, JJ, who prefers to pull on the left. Zirkel says the siblings work great off each other on skinny parts of the trail, but there have been some interesting moments in the more open sections.
Well, you put them on some of these trails, for instance, the lagoon here coming into Uniclete, and it's as wide as the world. And those two little dogs are pulling harder against each other, one on the right and one on the left, than they are pulling forward. And the older dogs behind them, they're like, knock it off, you know, just go straight there. We can see the checkpoint lights. And Bully, or Stormy and JJ are so convinced that they gotta be on the right side that they end up working against each other, but we made it.
Zirkel says at this point in the race, she's coveting each of her dogs, hoping she doesn't have to drop any more. She wants them all to make it to Nome. In Uniclete, I'm Annie Fite.
Two more sled dogs have died in the race from the team of rookie Lou Packer. Packer was found yesterday 22 miles past Iditarod by searchers in a plane. Rescuers were sent out to look for Packer of Wasilla, as well as two other rookies, New Jersey musher Kim Darst and Blake Maitrey from Two Rivers. They have all scratched from the race.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Northern Air Cargo, with scheduled flights to 16 destinations throughout Alaska every week. Northern Air Cargo, building strong relationships with the communities they serve.
Rural Alaskans will see an increase in the cost of the U.S. Postal Service bypass mail, but it won't be as bad as expected. Prices will go up in May about 12% to 17%. That's not as high as the 50% increases shippers and consumers feared and the Postal Service had initially planned. Alaska's congressional delegation asked that the expense be moderated, and the Postal Regulatory Commission responded with the new plan yesterday. Congressman Don Young says it should help rural Alaska.
It will not be as painful. It's not going to be, you know, as good as it was, but it definitely will not be as painful as it was originally proposed.
Bypass mail allows people in rural Alaska to send items by shippers or air carriers directly to villages, bypassing the postal system, but still shipping at its rates. It's a crucial way of getting groceries and goods to Bush, Alaska. Congressman Young warns the problem is far from solved and will come up again because the Postal Service is losing money across the board.
The U.S. mail in Alaska is probably the most important aspect of all the services we have compared to the lower 48. And overall, they've lost a tremendous amount of money, not from Alaska, although this was one of the areas they did lose money, the bypass mail. They lost it because of emails and because of all the faxing and all the other aspects of the new communication system.
The post office loses about $7 million a year on bypass mail. Developers of the proposed Donlin Creek gold mine are rolling out their plan to residents on the Kuskokwim River. The Donlin Creek Company is on the brink of applying for the various permits they will need before they can begin constructing the mine. They hosted a one-day exhibit in the village of Aniak, providing upriver residents with more details about their plan. For member station KYUK, Shane Iverson reports.
The scene in the Aniak Community Building resembles a science fair. Tables line the conference room, each with a booth covering an aspect of the proposed mine. Charts, maps, and displays provide attendees with an overview of the proposed project. At one booth, a video display shows silver salmon pushing upstream. Aquatic biologist Ed Fleming is manning the booth.
We've established at the mouth of Crooked Creek a underwater video camera that basically funnels all the fish past the camera, so we count every single fish, salmon, that comes up the Crooked Creek.
Moving around the room, one can feel and even shake a piece of 60-millimeter plastic. Clint Logue is a geotechnical engineer. He says this is the kind of liner that will be used to hold waste tailings after the gold is extracted.
This type of liner has been used on a lot of different applications, from landfills to tailings facilities to numerous applications.
These are just a few of the technicians on hand. Until now, only a handful of the project's leadership has been available to speak publicly on the project. Donlin Creek is described by many as the largest undeveloped gold resource in North America. That resource is currently estimated to be 30 million ounces. The site is located near the village of Crooked Creek off the Kuskokwim River. It has been explored for over 12 years, and now a plan to extract that gold is all but finished, says technical manager James Fugue.
A lot of what we're looking at now is not so much the sort of the fundamental engineering aspects of how we're going to do it, but things like, you know, completing a cost estimate for the project, doing some of the final detailed bits of engineering, you know, where does this thing go on that bridge or where does that thing go on this bridge. It's those little details that take a long time to finish.
While Donlin is making their experts available, they will not be making public their feasibility study. That's the plan that spells out how the mine will be constructed and operated. Nick Enos, the environmental engineer, says that will stay with the developers.
Generally, the feasibility study itself is not made available generally to the public. It's used for financial decisions, so it's an internal document.
The public will get their information from permit applications and at meetings and exhibits such as this one. Invitations to the exhibit were extended to residents living nearest the proposed mine. That included 11 villages between Lower Kalskag and Stony River. Sleepmute resident Margie Melick is 71. She traveled down the river by snow machine to learn more.
I'm all confused yet. I'm confused, really. They always make it sound good.
It's not the details, though, that concern Melick. It's the history of mining pollution that causes her to worry. She's undecided whether it should go forward or not. Melick's travel companion, Sophie Gregory, also came down from Sleepmute. But unlike Melick, she has decided to support the mine, although they share the same concerns.
I'm for it, yeah, but I don't know, it's kind of scary to think about, you know, our future of our kids, too.
The Kuskokwim River has the largest catch of subsistence fish in the entire state. In many households along the river, salmon is eaten every single day. Gregory says any threat of pollution needs to be taken seriously.
Because if it affects our, if they get all that stuff, you know, into the river, it might just kill all our fish. Yeah, and our animals that live on land too.
Gregory says her husband worked at the Donlin site as it was explored, and their other travel companion, Laura Crane, helped out at the camp as a housekeeper and kitchen aide.
When I worked there for 4 years, it was a good income, and you know, I was ahead on my bills, had food in my house, and did some things for my kids.
Near the entrance of the conference room stands Nick Alexi. He's the mayor of Lower Kalskag, and he's wearing a camouflage hat that reads Donlin Creek.
No, I haven't been into Donlin Creek, but I had to hear many good things of Donlin Creek since they're the only ones that are having
job opportunities within the Kuskokwim area.
Alexi says several dozen people from Kalskag have worked at the Donlin site. He says employment is his most immediate concern.
They are really struggling at this moment. You know, there's only about 30-35% of the people working.
Residents in the lower Kuskokwim can expect to see the exhibit as well. Donlin says they will be bringing it to Bethel sometime next month. I'm Shane Iverson.
Two bills making permanent changes to the Power Cost Equalization Program are in the House and Senate Finance Committees follow legislative action today. The House Community and Regional Affairs Committee today approved its version of the measure that would continue the temporary changes approved during last year's special legislative session on energy. Aaron Harrington, a staff member for the bill's sponsor, Alan Osterman of Kodiak, said the measure would perpetuate the $1 per kilowatt hour assistance ceiling that was part of last year's decision. Without it, she said, the price ceiling will return to 52.5 cents this summer. The administration estimates that the change will increase the needs of the fund by $5.5 million a year, but Harrington says that is not a fixed amount.
When prices are low, there will be no impact. By keeping the ceiling at $1, does not obligate the state to anything in times of low energy prices. But what it does do is, when prices are high, it gives an opportunity to provide some power cost equity for rural communities that have not been able to benefit from some of our longer term investments that we've made in power generation infrastructure in certain areas of the state.
There was no dispute over the needs of the beneficiaries of the subsidy. Bob Charles, the energy coordinator for the Association of Village Council Presidents, said oil and gas prices have doubled in the last 2 years. Home heating oil is now between $8 and $10 a gallon. Monthly electric bills average around $360. He said the current PCE rate drops the monthly bills to less than $200.
Energy costs take up a very significant portion of many of the households' disposable income, right around 60-70%, primarily because of the price hikes in the energy costs. And we do feel that because of any further increase in fuel costs and electric rates, this will have the effect of making fuel and electricity unaffordable.
Charles said the remaining 30-40% of income goes to cover high food prices, a 10-pound bag of potatoes at $11 and a gallon of milk at $9. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at APRN.org. We had reports tonight from Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Tim Bedoni in White Mountain, and Shane Iverson in Aniak. APRN's Libby Casey reported from Washington, D.C., and Dave Donaldson from Juneau. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineers are Gooseberry Peter and Dave Waldron. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
First National Bank Alaska, serving Alaskans' financial needs for nearly a century. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender. If you know an Alaskan struggling to find health insurance because of a high-risk chronic medical condition or other uninsurable reasons, encourage them to talk to a local insurance broker about the Alaska Comprehensive Health Insurance Association. ACHIA was created by the state legislature to meet the needs of Alaskans, and several plans are available. Talk to an independent insurance broker. Information also available at www.achia.com. This message sponsored by the ACHIA.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.